lot of the suffering in the world is related to property, and having it or not having it, or getting it or losing it. And it seemed to me that the Dharma didn't directly address it. And then I was walking along one day, and out of the sky it hit me that the second precept, right after don't kill people, was don't steal their things. To have the wisdom not to take what isn't freely given. So tonight's talk is about property and the precepts, specifically the second precept. Things, most of the time in the Dharma, are objects of desire or craving. And craving doesn't have a very good reputation in the Dharma. So, you know, you might think that the Dharma is disdaining toward things, but it's clearly very important. Monastics, for example, have very, very few possessions, but they're vital. They have a robe, which is their clothing, their protection against exposure to the weather, shelter, and maybe the most important, it's their identity. They walk around in this robe and everybody knows that's a monk or a nun. And they have a bowl for begging. That's their food. And that's also the way that they act out the decision that they've made to depend on the generosity of others. So for monastics, their relationship to things is a very powerful letting go and a trust in kindness. And this relationship to things is almost the opposite of the greed that leads to stealing. And it's also a very powerful teaching of how precious the things we need can be to us. I mean, how precious is that robe and that bowl? So it can act as an inspiration for us to examine our connection to things and to honor the value of what supports us in life and to let go of clutter, the things that we cling to for reasons that aren't helpful to us. I mean, I've got a lot of clutter that I own because I just am too lazy to sort out what I don't need. That's not a good reason to own it. But there are worse reasons. The second precept is one of the Dharma's many invitations to consider life's fragility and how things do support our survival, such as the roof over our heads, the food in the kitchen, the means to our livelihood, such as our car or our bus pass, our clothing, and the tools of our trade. For many of us, it's our computers or our smartphones. And we've all had to acquire these things and to maintain them and to replace them at some point. And very often, the expense of acquiring, maintaining, and replacing can be troubling to us. But it's a lot easier when it's not a surprise, when someone hasn't just removed it from our possession. I've had my car stolen a couple times. It's a very difficult thing to get through. So I was having the purse stolen with identification and all of that. Theft can be the result of some very powerful cravings. It can be a craving for the thing. I've just got to have that smart-looking purse that Rebecca carries around. Or a craving for the act of acquiring. Or for getting away with it. The second precept guards us against all of these urges. It just says, no, don't go there. If it hasn't been freely offered to you, don't bother it. And it's a great training for our letting go of the craving for things in general. Not just letting go of the urge to acquire things illicitly, but just recognizing that if we don't need it, we don't need it. Things can also be the objects of attachment. Once we've got them, we don't want to let them go. We've all felt the pain of losing valued things at one point or another. I gave a Dharma talk within the past month or so on living through loss. It's dukkha when we lose things that we value. And the second precept reminds us that others feel the same dukkha that we do when they lose things. So it helps us bear in mind the principle of non-harming and the principle of kindness. Refraining from taking something. Maybe they wouldn't miss it, but our kindness errs perhaps on the side of, well, maybe they will. So not stealing protects others, and it protects us from the consequences. And I think primarily it's guilt, the regret of, deep in my heart, I knew I shouldn't do that. The example that they use all the time at retreats when they go through the precepts the first day is, you see somebody's shampoo in the shower room and you think, gee, I'd like to try that, see what it's like. No, hasn't been freely offered. Maybe it has, but maybe it's just lying there by mistake. Someone forgot it. They're not actively offering it to you. So refrain. But, you know, there are other consequences besides guilt, and they can be pretty serious. So to be protected from, oh, for example, arrest is kind of nice. So this also invites us to look at how we regard thieves. What comes to mind very quickly, I'm sure, is blame. And my notes here say I'm supposed to smile and wink. Because it's easy. Someone's a thief, bad person. And yet we've just looked at the urges that result in theft, and I'm sure we've all had them. I remember when I was a kid, I went through a phase of shoplifting because I loved getting away with it. Then I got caught. The laws of karma will lead us to compassion for anyone who is so caught up in these urges that they would steal a child's custom wheelchair. I read an article about that recently. Also, elderly people's savings. It happens all the time. Hungry people's food. Now, we certainly have compassion for the victims of thefts like these. And even less outrageous thefts of my purse or whatever. But the American justice system leaves many people, particularly African American men, with not many other choices for making a living. The war on drugs sent a lot of people to prison with felony convictions, and they're unemployable. And they've been trained in a skill, now, years in prison, they learn how to be good at stealing. So I can't blame them without a little backsplash on my own conscience. In a complex society such as America, the response to theft is the law. And so, blame is not our burden. And you might ask, well, then what is my role? Other than I don't do it, how does that become an issue? From about 5 years ago to 2 years ago, in my neighborhood, there was a rash of burglaries. There were 2 to 5 happening every week. And the paranoia in the neighborhood was such that we got together, which was hard right there, and hired a private patrol. And within 6 months, there was an incident where a guard followed a thief. I mean, no question. The guy was running down the street with an armload of somebody else's possessions. And the guard followed this fellow. And at one point, the thief turned and came at the guard with a sharp object. Turned out to be a screwdriver, but still. And in self-defense, the guard shot the guy carefully in the leg. Boy, was there an uproar. The neighborhood just erupted in controversy, and there were all kinds of opinions about this. And as a result, now the guards no longer carry any weapon, and they do not follow suspects, and they just call the police if they see something suspicious. I think the majority of the neighbors felt that this incident bordered on vigilantism by proxy, that we were just one step away from hanging the varmints. We'd hired this person to do it for us. And that shouldn't be the way the rule of law works in a civilized society. But the problem with the rule of law is, whose rule? Social scientists note that societies with many groups with a diversity of interests, the law is always going to be against some groups. It's going to have to favor some at the expense of others because these are conflicting interests very often. And we can see that. There are very clear statistics showing that wealth is intensely concentrated in the top 10%. Top 10% owns more than everybody else combined. And this is largely because of tax law and also laws allowing money to sway legislators, the Citizens United decision. So wealthy people have greater opportunities to make money and to save it. The more you have, the more you can get and keep. And these are laws such as the way corporations offer tax and liability shields to individuals. You form a corporation and you're not liable. And bankruptcy laws and having your bank account in offshore banks, which aren't taxed, and multinational corporations now, because of the World Trade Organization, they can force wages down because globalization means that any worker anywhere on the planet has to compete with labor anywhere else. These multinational corporations can just move their operations anywhere in a heartbeat. So I call this the hidden theft that results from the social legal structure that allows rich people to just siphon money away from everyone else and then run for president. The impact is harshest on the poor, the people who are the least able to absorb that impact. The middle class, quite loudly, complains about the impact that this has on it. The middle class has really shrunk in the past decade, and it's putting a strain on the whole U.S. economy, the whole world economy, in fact. But it's nowhere near as bad on the middle class as it is on the working class or the poor. And then, let's not forget, the centuries of just outright theft from Native American and African American peoples, where virtually no reparations have been made. And then is the neocolonialism that America participated in the last 150 years that took money from the rest of the world and pumped it into the U.S. economy. So this is where we are. The Dharma is real clear about situations of one person to one other person. But what does the second precept say about theft by social inequality? Even if we are the involuntary recipients of stolen goods. Many activists have many answers, and many of those answers are good. Personally, for the purpose of practice, I think the questions are better. And I think we should keep asking them for the rest of our lives. So we can start with our relationship with things and ask how we feel about having and losing things that are needed, are sentimentally precious, maybe family heirlooms, pictures of people we love, and then those things that are desired for less noble reasons, like luxury, status. They just make us feel good. This is a rich field of inquiry. And even though I put those things in an order, please don't assume that I'm pretending to know that any is better than another. These are just questions that we can all ask ourselves. Also, how we feel about taking advantage of any chances that others don't have to get more money and things. I'm not suggesting any answers. That's for you. If I have a suggestion, it's don't go to the answers. Stay with the questions. So let's continue to recognize the harm done to those who are deprived of things, whether or not those things are important, or however the people are deprived. Let's reaffirm our commitment not to contribute to that harm and keep asking, what can I do to protect others. There are some options that are clear. Vote, sign petitions, circulate petitions, contribute money to organizations, attend important meetings, speak out, and in parentheses, speak out wisely. You know, there's a tendency to harangue the choir, the already converted, the people who really don't need another lecture. Neither the questions nor the answers are simple, but the benefit of exploring them is clear. We will hold things in this life with deeper respect and love as they deserve. And we'll honor all beings' right to be secure in having them. And therefore, we'll celebrate and enjoy the value of what supports us all in life. Thank you.